It's a bit early to break out cigars, but Lonesome George, the last known Galapagos giant tortoise, may soon become a father. George is the only known living Giocello nigra abindungi tortoise in the world. He's estimated to be between 90 and 100 years old, which scientists say is actually sexual peak for giant tortoises who can live to be 150. George resides in the Galapagos National Park. Because he is, in the description of the Guinness Book of World Records, the rarest living creature, he's a difficult man to find a mate for. Scientists have been playing Match.com for Lonesome George since 1993 and have put two females of different subspecies into his pen. But I guess he preferred to watch ESPN. George aroused scientists almost as much as himself last year by mating for the first time during the 36 years that he's been in captivity. The eggs of his partner turned out to be infertile. Now, the National Park says that Lonesome George has recently awarded his seal of approval, if you please, to the eggs of another partner. The result is being cared for in an incubator. Scientists will know if there will be a little not-as-Lonesome George, or Georgia, within 120 days. If so, that would make George one of the oldest natural fathers on record. Another mark for Tom Watson to shoot for.
The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come, come the day you're mine.
Tony Bennett, you can see the prospective papa on our website, npr.org.
We've only tasted the wine. We're gonna drain a cup dry. Wait till your charms are ripe for these arms to surround.
Hey, cats, you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. And speaking of beer, time for sports. The baseball trading deadline is less than a week away. Who will go where? For how much? Joined now by Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. I'm not on the trading block, by the way, just so you know.
Oh, my gosh.
At least I'm hoping I'm not.
Did I have a deal set up for you? Well, let's reconsider. Friday is the non-waiver trading deadline for major leagues. Do you expect some major ones?
Well, obviously, the big name out there is Roy Halladay, the pitcher for the Toronto Blue Jays, and any team that he goes to, any contender, is going to be a World Series, a very serious World Series contender. Philadelphia is the team that most people seem to think that he could go to, the Dodgers as well. It does seem, however, that there's also, you never know when the Yankees or the Red Sox are going to sneak in and do that thing they do with their hundreds of millions of dollars, but I think it would send a very bad message to the good people of Toronto to trade your best pitcher to a team that you play 19 times.
Yeah. I want to turn to football to talk about Michael Vick. He met with Commissioner Roger Goodell this week to talk about his future with the league, now that he's out of prison and home supervision. Does he have a future in the NFL?
Well, it's a great question, and I think even the larger question is whether or not it's possible to pay one's debt to society when he had first been involved in these dogfighting charges. Yes, he did lie to the commissioner, and he had been suspended indefinitely in August of 2007. As we know, he then went to prison for two years. And so now you have one school of thought, especially the players, who are saying, okay, he did his time. He paid his debt. He went to prison, and now he should be able to resume his life.
Yeah.
Now the commissioner, Roger Goodell, is deciding whether or not to suspend him again as further punishment. And this is a great question, because here's the bottom line. If he does get, they're talking about a 2-6 game suspension, chances are he's not going to be able to play very effectively this year. He's going to miss out on parts of training camp, depending on what their deal is. And so I think that right now the commissioner really has to decide if he's done his time. I seem to think that if he's already done his 2 years in prison, what is the point of suspending him even further?
And fan reaction has to be a factor, too.
Well, fan reaction and protest reaction. Let's not forget that PETA is a very strong, very well-organized organization, and there is no love lost between that organization and Michael Vick. And also, a lot of people still feel that what he did was heinous, and I believe that it was. But in comparison, There are people who have taken other people's lives. Leonard Little killed someone in a drunk driving accident whose punishments have been less than this.
Yeah. Mark Burley of the White Sox. Did you know he pitched a perfect game against Tampa Bay on Thursday?
I heard.
Yeah. And, of course, a great assist from Dwayne Wise.
Yeah.
The outfielder. He's obviously a great pitcher. How can a guy who, God bless, might not be able to throw a ball hard enough to break a window be one of the best pitchers in baseball?
Well, because pitching isn't just the ability to throw the ball hard. You have to throw it where you want it, when you want it. And pitching really is an art. You have to be able. It's like a great game of chess where you're trying to parry what your opponent is doing. And in baseball, instead of trying to throw the ball as hard as you can, you have to throw it at different speeds in different locations. I really loved Mark Burley's perfect game because it was one of the more democratic perfect games. He'd only struck out six guys, and it had more action for the players. And I think when you go in there and you strike out everybody, it's just you and the batter. But this game, everybody contributed, and obviously Dwayne Wise's catch was a phenomenal catch. Not only did he stop a home run, but he caught the ball falling down, and it was a great, great accomplishment.
And finally, Tour de France, wrapping up this weekend, Lance Armstrong in third place, Alberto Contador, his teammate and sometimes rival, seems to be a real worthy successor.
Seems to be a worthy successor. We've got 2 days to go. Lance is trailing by about 5 minutes. I think it was 5 minutes and 21 seconds the last time I checked. And so it does look like there's going to be a new champion. And I think third place is for a guy who hadn't ridden, it's a pretty good accomplishment, although it does seem like Lance Armstrong is bigger than the tour and he's bigger than the news and all, but I think that Contador is very much worthy and very combative in his own sense. I do like watching him.
Howard Bryant, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, the president stepped up his health care reform efforts, but got distracted by an incident involving the arrest of a friend, and Secretary of State Clinton has a verbal duel with North Korea. NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore joins us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And the attempts by the Obama administration to nail down health care reform, get something passed, big news this week, but it looks as it's not going to happen nearly as quickly as the administration would like. What happened to that August deadline?
Well, what happened with the president and his famous deadline when he said he really wanted to have a bill ready by the middle of August when they go off on their vacation, what happened to it is that they did not reach agreement in the Senate committee to put a bill on the floor. So the whole thing is now shoved off until after the August vacation.
President Obama has always said he was concerned that if he didn't set a deadline and there was no action, that there would be no action, period.
That's right. And then when the deadline is passed, he says, what deadline?
Yeah. Well, what happens next to health care reform?
What happens next to health care is that everybody goes away, comes back, and goes back to where they were. That is to say, they resume on the Senate side the attempt to get a bipartisan bill, which they need on the Senate side, and the House waits. You know, one must say, in spite of how bad it looks, they've made a lot of progress. And I was quite struck this week by seeing a copy of Newsweek with a cover article by Senator Ted Kennedy, you know, and the cover has a headline which says, "We're almost there." And I guess Ted Kennedy would like it to be almost there. He's given his life to this, but we don't know.
A neighborhood incident, ordinarily, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, became a national story this week because it involved distinguished Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr.
Right.
He was arrested for disorderly conduct outside of his home in Cambridge. Police were called to the house to investigate a possible break-in. Professor Gates says that he and his driver were forcing open the front door of his own house. The door was jammed. Now, this is where versions differ because, of course, the Cambridge police accuse the professor of being obstreperous and uncooperative with the officer. Professor Gates says that the victim.
Nobody differs on what the president then did. Plunge himself into the act at the end of a news conference, the purpose of which was to talk about health care.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody could do an immense distraction from health care, it was the president himself. And I'm sure he must have wondered later what led him to do it. Well, I suspect it is time to say that this country is not yet finished with racial profiling, and that there's a great deal of sensitivity to anything that sounds like it. And so when Professor Gates got an impression that he was being treated in the way that maybe white people trying to break open the lock on their door would not have been treated, when they realized what was involved there, we were looking at people acting as they used to act, and which we hoped were over, especially with an African-American president, but racial profiling lives, or the fear of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was struck by the reaction of the Cambridge police officer, who took special exception to the charge that he was racially profiling.
Well,
anybody.
That's right.
The thing that also carries a very heavy sting.
Yeah, there are so many ironies involved in this. Sergeant Crowley, the officer in question, was one who was in charge of briefing the police on racial profiling. Here's a president who we know where he stands, and everybody acts out a part as though they were in some former age.
Major corruption scandal, apparently, in New Jersey. More than 40 people were arrested this week and charged, mayors, state assemblymen, and rabbis. What's behind the charges?
What's behind the charges is that they apparently were involved, and they had them on tape because they had somebody who was willing to cooperate with the FBI and had them on tape indicating they were mayors, officials were accepting bribes in order to do favors for developers and real estate people. So, and it was so widespread and had gone on for so long, it was almost impossible. Now, I am old enough to remember the Jersey City with Mayor Frank Haig in the 1920s, when Jersey City was an example of corruption in city government. It's taken a long time now to beat that record, but they have.
And finally, Secretary of State Clinton was on a trip to Asia this week, and she got into kind of a back and forth indirectly with North Korea. Was this all a verbal duel, or is there something more serious going on? And uniquely personal, the remarks the North Korean leadership made.
That is right. Secretary Clinton said that the North Koreans were acting like an unruly child, and they answered back in kind. I think what we're seeing is soft power at work. Secretary Clinton doesn't talk about we're going to bomb you or anything like that. She just says, if you would like to get into the, be among the nations of the world, then you have to act a little differently. And it's very interesting. Then she goes there and there's a question of Myanmar and whether they're doing something with North Korea. And she says, don't do that. Don't do that. And I'm not sure whether she gets anywhere that way. But it's an interesting phenomenon.
NPR Senior News Analyst Dan Shore, thank you.
Sure, sure thing.
Michael Jackson and U.S. Army Lieutenant Brian Bradshaw have little in common. Well, there is one important detail. They both died last month, on the same day, June 25th. Of course, we've heard about Michael Jackson. The week's war casualties in Afghanistan were destined to be overlooked, or so it seemed. But then Lieutenant Bradshaw's friends and family mobilized to make certain their loved one's sacrifice is not overlooked. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Bradshaw's hometown in western Washington state.
Walking and driving in the small town of Steilacoom, one thing you notice right away is how many American flags there are. Seems like every other porch has one or a flagpole in the yard. It's not that surprising, I guess, considering this town is a favorite of retired and active duty military. The West Coast's largest army post, Fort Lewis, is right next door. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan hit a little closer to home here than most places. Still, it was a double shock to lose one of their own and then feel like the outside world didn't pause or notice.
And that was hard. That was a real hard pill to swallow.
Terry Nelson is the youth minister at the area's Catholic church. She says Afghanistan war casualty Brian Bradshaw was like a son to her.
Yes, we definitely want to recognize that a big celebrity, king of pop, you know, has passed away. But let's put things in perspective and also remember we are sending people off daily and they're fighting and they're not all returning.
In Northern Virginia, Bradshaw's aunt was feeling much the same way, or worse. She penned an anguished letter to the editor before leaving for the funeral.
My nephew, Brian Bradshaw, was killed by an explosive device in Afghanistan on June 25th, the same day that Michael Jackson died. Mr. Jackson received days of wall-to-wall coverage in the media. Where was the coverage of my nephew or the other soldiers who died that week?
Gillis touched a chord for many people. Thanks to the Internet, the letter published in the Washington Post raced around the world. It landed in network news offices. Bloggers ran with it. Even soldiers and airmen in Afghanistan read it.
People were telling me both that they thought that I had said something that they had wanted to say for a long time, that I had spoken for them, but also they were offering tremendous outpourings of support and letting me know that they would not let his death go unnoticed.
Gillis's dining room is now mail central. The table is piled with letters, along with a wide variety of supplies for troop care packages.
And then this is an interesting pile. This was something Brian had asked for towards the end.
Candy, crayons, and markers are in the pile.
They want things to hand out to the children, the local children.
Gillis's nephew had his sights set on a military career since early in high school. In college, Bradshaw's Army ROTC mentor, Andy Eklund, recalls his unusually strong drive toward public service.
He was a patriotic kid, but his sense of service, I think, was bigger than that. It was more of just an overall sense of serving humanity. I think he could have gone into the Peace Corps just as easily as he went into the Army.
People who knew him say he attacked life in a positive way. He was a county search and rescue volunteer, a camp counselor, and an altar boy. He traveled the world and went to Army Ranger School. Again, Terry Nelson.
He did more in his 24 years than most of us do in a lifetime. He never took a moment for granted, and too many of us do. And I think that's his message, that's his legacy.
Lieutenant Bradshaw deployed to Afghanistan with an infantry regiment from Fort Richardson, Alaska. The officer was buried with full military honors near Tacoma, Washington.
Let us pray together as God's children. Our Father, who art in heaven.
Brian Bradshaw was 24. For NPR News, I'm Tom Bonsi.
We have some sad news to share this week. Joan Rappaport, wife of our longtime sports commentator Ron Rappaport, died after a struggle with cancer. Joan was an artist, a wit, and a wonderful companion. She celebrated her 65th birthday 2 years ago by climbing Mount Whitney. And Stone and Holt Weeks have died in a car accident. They're the sons of Linton Weeks, national correspondent for NPR Digital News, and his wife, Jan. Stone was 24. He's recently been Professor Douglas Brinkley's researcher at Rice University. Holt was 20 and was going to be a junior at Rice. A family friend told us that Stone and Holt were beautiful, smart, and deeply engaged with the world. We send our friends and their families our love and prayers. Stone and Holt loved history. This was one of their favorite songs, Echo, by The Hush Sound. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.